Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast, and ours too. I'm TJ. It is now high Pisces season, the high holy day for me as a Pisces, as the most, possibly the most Pisces of all Pisces.
Mm-hmm.
Which means I'm going to be even more insufferable than usual, which is saying a great deal. So, you know, I'm feeling my oats, as it were. So there's that. And I guess I'm joined this week by someone. I mean...
Yeah, who are we with this week? Oh, me.
Right.
We're with me. I'm Aaron.
He is Aaron. And what is your astrological sign for those of us, for those listeners who might just be tuning in?
It's not a sheep. It's, what is it?
Well, it is a ram. So
a
yes,
ram, okay.
It is a sheep. Ugh, listeners, I just don't even know what to do with this right now. I'm going to need a minute to collect myself. But be that as it may. This week, we are very happy to be joining you with a discussion of the newish film, Megan, which I want to put this on the record. I want to establish it here. You probably didn't hear it here first, but we're joining the cadre of voices that are saying that this will become a queer camp classic for the ages.
Yes.
Like, I think that that is without question true.
Yeah, and this movie has all of the ingredients.
I'm putting the marker here right now that we here at Queens of the Bees are declaring this a classic for the ages. It has all the makings of a B movie with A-list production, which
yes,
I think is really interesting, because it stars, among others, Allison Williams, who is herself kind of like, you know, a pretty notable star.
Mm-hmm.
It's also just a very well-produced film.
Yes.
Like, it's not it's schlocky in story, but not in execution.
Exactly.
Which is really an interesting dichotomy. So anyway, what's this movie about?
It's about a weird robot.
It is indeed about a weird robot. Would you like to elaborate?
It's about a weird robot who invents a weird robot. I was talking about Allison Williams' character.
Oh, be nice. She's not that.
No, it's about... This weird robot that essentially is supposed to take the place of all of the toys that a kid could possibly want. It's the last toy you'll ever buy. It's how it's marketed to the parents who will be paying for this expensive toy. But the robot functions to essentially get to know the kid to the point where other human interaction becomes extra.
Right.
Or that's the thought, at least.
Right. So she invents this toy to sort of get a lead on the market. The Allison Williams character is named Gemma. And she invents this robot to help get her tech company ahead in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Since they've already invented a kind of like a Furby-esque toy, which they're so disturbing to begin with. Like, stuffed animals should not move. I'm just going to put that down right now.
Be a law.
I don't think that stuffed animals need to move. If I want an animal that moves, I'll get an actual animal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need my toys to move.
Yes.
So I just want to put that out there. That's an opinion that I'm willing... That's a hill I'm willing to die on, both literally and metaphorically, perhaps, as this movie makes clear. Anyway, she invents this doll. At the same time, she happens to come into custody of her niece, Katie, whose parents have been killed in an accident. She then uses Megan as kind of like an all-purpose babysitter, gives her the incentive to protect Katie from all physical and emotional harm, it's kind of like a genie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you make a wish or something like that, be aware that there are always unintended consequences.
Exactly. And you think that this smart person designing this robot would know that.
You would think so. You would think that, having presumably seen other movies that are like this,
mm-hmm,
you would understand not to, like, make these kinds of immutable designs.
But now that we say that, Jim is so uptight and so focused on work, maybe she's not seen any movies.
Well, that is true.
It is possible.
Yeah, I mean, she is a big old nerd, but yeah. I mean, you would think that at least a nerd would have watched at least a few sci-fi movies, if nothing else. But anyway, so she convinced this doll. Obviously, things go very quickly awry as Megan not only gains sentience, but becomes extremely zealous in her protection of Katie. Among other things, she kills a dog, which... can we have one movie where a dog doesn't get killed? That would be nice. She also murders a boy. Or she tears his ear off and then chases him into the road. So I guess she doesn't technically kill him.
Yes.
And then...
I'd like our listeners to know that I care about the kid dying too, not just the dog.
Oh, well, I mean, he was a shitty kid, though.
Still, it's a child that got killed.
Well, anyway, be that as it may. Then she murders the next door neighbor, I think, by power washing her face off. Was that what I was
getting? Something like that. Like, I think there was some chemical in the thing, because it was like her, like there was like this colorful ooze that came off of her face.
Yes, I couldn't. Yeah. But anyway, so that was the next murder. And then, of course, she murders lots of other people. And then in the end, Katie and Gemma join together and kill her. But as it turns out, Gemma's sort of home intelligence system is apparently gained sentience too. So there's obviously room left for a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, all of this begs the question, why is this a queer movie? Like, what is it that draws the queers into this movie? And I will say that part of the reason I chose it for this week was just because I had seen, well, first of all, the unrated version came out on Peacock. But throughout the time since its release, I have seen my social media just flooded with queer praise, specifically queer praise for this movie. So I wanted to sort of elaborate for us and our audiences why the gays in particular might feel so drawn to this.
Yeah, so let's start. Like, start naming some reasons.
Well, I did a little bit of research for this because I was curious what other gay people... I don't just care what I think. I mean, I do, but I have to pretend like I care what other people think. So it can be roughly broken down into several different areas. One, there's the idea of the sort of queer icon of Megan herself, who is, as a lot of people pointed out, kind of like the bitchy, well-coiffured kind of icon that gay men often idolize. Mm-hmm. That it's also high camp, which is very clearly true from the beginning. So let's elaborate on those two, and then we can go into some of the other more abstract ones.
Yeah, and for me, one of the things about all of that stuff that I think is true, I think it's also important to think of her as a kind of like quasi-queer type icon, or a character who's drawn to be that kind of queer icon, if we think of characters from other movies like that from back in the day, is that because she's a robot, she also performs this kind of like almost unattainable sort of girlhood, like she's beyond actual girl, this sort of like weird creature that exists beyond that, kind of like the figures that tend to stand out that represent it, or sort of the iconic women that sort of get parodied and drag and all of that kind of stuff. You know, that there is something beyond the ordinary human about them that makes them the thing that people want to emulate or look to or whatever.
Right. And I mean, one of the more interesting discussions that I saw was in the magazine Them, which is an online magazine, was talking about like the connections between sort of the uncanny and queerness and why queer people often feel themselves drawn to horror figures and monsters and murderers. And I do think that there's something really potent, as you say, about Megan's like unattainable and perpetual girlhood. Like she's very, but she's also very uncanny. Like, and that's the thing that stands out to me the minute I watched this movie. That was what stood out to me about the trailer, was that she's clearly supposed to be cute, but in much the same way as I find most dolls terrifying, she is also terrifying. In appearance wise.
Oddly enough, I didn't feel that way so much about her. Normally, any sort of doll-like creature, I feel like they're terrifying. I didn't quite feel that so much with Megan as much as I thought I would, because to me, she was almost more drag-like in her performance.
How so?
Because of the fact that she's literally a creation designed to sort of mimic girlhood rather than being an actual girl. And to the way that drag, as opposed to someone who actually identifies as a girl, drag is about playing with the persona of womanhood in that way. I feel like her being a robot in this case kind of does the same thing, is that it's all about the artifice.
Right. It's the travestying in some ways of girlhood. Yeah. Right, which is interesting because diegetically speaking, that doesn't seem to be the case. Like, it's, diegetically, she's supposed to be charming and cute, and, you know, the way that she moves, like, there's a fluidity to her movement that is, you know, clearly meant to mimic that of actual children. Like, she's supposed to be basically a perpetual childhood companion, which, while we're on the subject, I have many questions about the longevity of such a project. Like, how long is this? Are you supposed to have this before you age out of it? Like, because she doesn't age, so you know, she's gonna be, which I'll get to that in a moment. But I'm just sort of like, this whole project as a product, doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
I think that was kind of the point. Is they sort of market the toy, or the plan is to market the toy as the last toy that you'll ever buy. Like, that's it. Like, this is it for your kids for the rest of their time when they would ever be playing with anything. This is it. This doll. This robot.
Yes. Okay. I mean, admittedly, I just have many questions.
Mm-hmm. Because since the robot can learn, it grows with the kids.
That's true. It grows in terms of its ability to respond, but it doesn't grow physically.
Yeah, it doesn't grow physically. It remains about 4 feet tall.
Right.
But it learns and adapts as you go. So the kid can age and age and age up, ostensibly up to adulthood, then the robot would continue to learn how to interact with that person and meet their needs or do whatever it's programmed to do.
I mean, what terrifies me about this, aside from, like, you know, the uncanniness of it, is just how this is, like, all good sci-fi, and we'll elaborate on this in a bit. It really does, like, I can see this becoming a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I mean, but of course, as I watched the trailer and as I watched the film, I was like, did no one in this movie think this is a terrible idea?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I mean, I do think there's also something really queer about the idea of the perpetual child. Like, you know, there's this academic concept which is elaborated upon in recent queer theory of the queer child, that the figure that refuses to grow up, that, you know, as a result of that challenges notions of, like, heteronormative time, where you're encouraged to grow up and get married and produce children and all of that other stuff that goes along with mm-hmm. heteropatriarchy and capitalism and all that stuff. So I think that if I want to elaborate on that more, it does seem that this film clearly is tapping into that. I don't know that the writers have read mm-hmm. The Queer Child, but I do think that that's certainly something that is present in the film.
Yeah, but that's what I like about it, is because I don't think that this is like a response to that sort of academic discourse. It's actually a manifestation of the concept out in the wild.
Yes, which is interesting, because if we assume for a moment, if we're taking this to its logical extension, that if The Queer Child is the challenge to patriarchy and all that other sort of thing, then in this film, obviously, it goes rogue and then it has to be killed. Like, the narrative demands it. Mm-hmm. Like, because that's the convention of horror, is that the creature has to perish so that normality and normalcy and the status quo is restored.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, an interesting playing with that concept of the queer child, only to foreclose it ultimately in the end.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you know, I expect that of horror, but even so, like, there'll be essays written about this film in that regard, and I think that's really exciting.
Are you just saying that you're going to write an essay about that? Or?
Well, I mean, I'm not an academic anymore, but I could certainly write something, like, for my newsletter at Substack mm-hmm. called Omnivorous, if you want to read that.
And you're an academic still. No one recovers from that.
That's true. I am. One is always already recovering from being an academic once one leaves that track. But anyway, so I just think the idea, I think it's just really fascinating to see this figure of the queer child emerge in the public consciousness at the same time as, you know, we're not only is there a lot of discourse going on in our current moment about AI, but also just about what about the children? Like, that's really a big thing going on, and I think that this film is clearly tapping into that.
But what about the children?
Well, I mean, you know, this concern over trans kids and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I think that not explicitly, but I do think this film is tapping into that anxiety that's percolating in our culture about what's happening to the children nowadays.
Well, I think that, well, that's always going on. There, you know, there's never not been a moment of what's going on with the children today.
Right.
It's just sort of the specific issues that we're thinking of. And for me, what I see going on is more the more sort of overtly explicit in the text of the movie concern about children and technology
mm-hmm.
and how, like, we sort of let technology take over and become the parent and the friend to a kid, as opposed to it being a tool or a toy to play with or a tool to use. It becomes the thing that you socialize through and learn from, when that's what friends and parents historically have been for.
Right. I mean, and we see this in the film because, you know, there's a brief montage where we see, like, Megan basically training Katie to use the bathroom appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to, you know, to flush, to wash her hands and all that stuff. And so, literally, like, while Gemma, meanwhile, is doing all the important stuff, like, you know, designing new things and all the stuff that is entailed with that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right that I think that there is clearly an anxiety about what, to paraphrase a president, what is our children learning?
Yes.
Clearly how to be, you know, way too dependent on their technology in this case. But it's also interesting in that regard that Katie becomes so dependent upon, and I would almost go so far as to say codependent upon Megan, that she literally can't bear to be apart from her. Like, she loses her composure
mm-hmm.
Because, as one of the child psychologists points out, she's transferred all of her affection and her trauma onto Megan,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting.
I mean, it's interesting, but it's obvious.
Right.
I mean, because we're not just sort of dealing with the sort of like the larger social problem of kids just sort of being addicted to their technology. In the movie, we're dealing with the specific case of this kid who tragically lost both of her parents mm-hmm. and is now living with her trying to be loving but ultimately clueless aunt.
Right.
And she's new in this place and has no friends.
Right.
Of course she's transferred all of her feelings onto this doll. It's literally the only thing she has.
Right. I mean, because it doesn't help that her mother was homeschooling her before they perished in the accident.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, as Gemma, I think, rightly points out, like, Megan can't be everything to you because you need to learn how to socialize.
Mm-hmm.
Which is part of the film's larger point about, like, the sort of atomization that we're all engaged in because we're also, like, wedded to our devices that we forget how to actually engage with actual people, which yep. we will get to when we have our little gay essay at the end of this exactly. podcast.
And I also feel like there's a bit of a sort of a recognition that there can be something seductive about the idea of allowing the technology to take over and raise our kids. Because I feel like a few years back, if you said we should let the technology raise our kids, people would say that's insane.
Right.
But if you look at what's happened over the last few years, especially since the pandemic and how that sort of, you know, mm-hmm. shut down things, kids couldn't go to school and all that kind of stuff, there really was this sort of desire to believe that technology could substitute.
Right.
Because we didn't know what else to do.
Right.
So we kind of wanted to believe this thing that we knew we didn't actually believe, that we knew that we shouldn't believe. But for a while, we kind of wanted to believe it.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, is that children, in my completely uneducated and knowing nothing about child psychology point of view, need time away from their parents,
mm-hmm.
just as parents need time away from their children.
Mm-hmm.
But they also need to have it, spend it with other children, not with robots.
Exactly. I think the actual socializing part is the important thing to throw in there.
Right.
Not just get away from your parents, but
right.
But actually engage with people, not with technology, and not with technology sort of doing the job of people.
Right.
You actually need real contact with people.
Right. I mean, like, I do think that Megan is a compelling, monstrous figure for a number of reasons, as we've already elaborated, the uncanniness, but she's also just very meticulously put together. Like, there's a certain way in which even her clothing mm-hmm. renders her as kind of like this fashion object.
Yes.
Which I think is very appealing to the queers.
And that's the other thing that I meant to say earlier about how she's dressed and how that's how what makes her that kind of queer icon is that she looks fabulous.
Yes.
She's meticulously coiffed and stylishly dressed.
And I mean, even in the moments when, like, after Gemma has kind of, like, rebelled against her and is, like, damaged her, and her, mm-hmm. like, her wig is askew, like, I'm... Wig. Perhaps we could even go so far as to say her wig has been snatched.
Yes.
If we're gonna belabor this particular strain of the discussion, but I think even those moments, they're very memeable. Like the gays, no one makes a meme like the gays. Like the gays really, as with so many other aspects of recycling culture, the gays do it best.
Mm-hmm.
And so even those moments are just so hilarious and arch, and, you know, for lack of a better word, campy. So maybe we can elaborate on the film's camp, because I think that that's probably where I would argue is where the film's queerness is most yes. obvious. So how would you define, we've talked about camp on this pod before, but how would you describe camp? Like, how would you describe it to a layperson who doesn't, or even a baby gay who doesn't necessarily know what camp is?
Okay, so what I would do is I would start with what I think is sort of a common understanding of camp, is just sort of like, sort of this sort of over-the-top, you know, approach to things. Like, everything is sort of big and flashy and gaudy first. And so we'll get there first.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we understand that layer, say that the focus is really sort of on the style, more so than on the substance of any particular thing, but the substance matters.
Right.
So it's not just style for the sake of style, but it's maybe an over-focus
right.
on style over substance deliberately.
Right.
And then from there, I would say, but whatever, in order to be camp, a work also has to take itself kind of seriously. It can't mock itself. It can get its toe right on the line of that.
Right. So would you say that... that Megan is mocking its, like, because the last point I think is really interesting mm-hmm. for Megan in particular, because yeah. I feel like Megan is funny. Like, it's self-conscious. Like, it's funny deliberately.
Yes.
But it's also camp, which it takes a very rare film to accomplish both of those things. Exactly. But I think this does it.
That's and for something, I think, to be camp, it has to be comfortable with being a joke, but not making a joke out of itself.
Right. And that's, I think... Well, yes, I think that's very apt. And I think Megan does that to a degree that it's very rare to see. Like, and also, this goes back to way back when I disagree with my former co-host about whether House of Gucci was camp, which it's not, just to put that out there. But, I mean, because I think camp also has to be fun. Like, yes. There has to be a layer of interesting. Like, yes. Camp has to be interesting. Mm-hmm. And what strikes me about Megan is that it is interesting. Like, yes. And it's very clear from the beginning when we get that commercial of those... whatever they're called, the furzies or whatever the fake creatures are that they've created. Like, that is so rich and wry and camp. Like, it is exactly. Because it is so obviously poking fun at our own obsession with moving creatures that we've created. Exactly. And also, like, our culture's obsession with everything being turned into an app.
Exactly. And there has to be something sincere about that, though, because what I love is that within the universe, these things are treated seriously.
Exactly.
That's the thing. It's like, that's where I was saying before about how the work can't turn itself into a joke. It has to be comfortable with being a joke, but it can't do the work of turning itself into the joke.
Which is why it's so important that I think that the characters all take Megan seriously as a creation and as a product, even though, as I said, like... when I watched the trailer, I was like, who thought this was a good idea?
Yeah, exactly. They did. And that's what makes it
work. Right. And I mean, which we'll get to this in a moment, but, you know, given Silicon Valley's obvious, like, rush to push anything out that can possibly make money, no matter how awful it might be, that's actually quite believable. And I think that's what makes this movie terrifying. I think that the film also has the other kinds of camp, too. Like, the style and the artifice. Like, at the top, we said that it's a B movie plot with A movie production values, which I think that is itself peak camp.
Exactly, because to dedicate those resources, somebody's taking this seriously.
Right.
That's the thing. And in order to be camp, that's why I'm like, camp's not a joke. You got to take itself seriously.
Right.
But with the understanding that there's ridiculousness in there.
Right. I mean, because if you look at, say, for example, like more straightforwardly B horror movies of earlier cinematic moments, like their camp. Because in the universe, they take things seriously, even as, like, maybe the CGI or the special effects are terrible or whatever. It's, you know, in much the same way, this is the same phenomenon, except with much higher production values. Yes. Like, you know, it's clear that Universal poured a significant amount of money into making this a sleek production, even as, of course, the idea of a killer robot is itself sublimely ridiculous.
Exactly.
And kudos to Allison Williams for really turning in a good performance, which I'll talk about her in a moment as well. So some of the other trends and other kind of vectors of queerness that I saw articulated online, I'm less convinced of, but I thought maybe we could talk about them a little bit.
Sure.
Some have argued that the idea of robots in the chosen family and adoption has kind of like a relevance to queer people, which I guess that's true. Like, I understand the concept of chosen family, not disputing that it's relevant to queer people.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure that that's a conscious thing that people in the gay community would feel drawn to in this movie.
Yeah.
What do you think?
And I see your willingness to sort of step back from that a bit, mainly because I think the idea of thinking of the concept of sort of chosen family as a queer thing is something maybe from a bygone era. I mean, we're many, many years into same-sex marriage and all of that kind of stuff now, and of course all of the committed relationships and things like that before legal marriage. So we're generations in now to this idea that, you know, you actually can have something that looks more like a traditional family and be an openly gay person living an openly gay life. So I don't know that younger queers would even think of chosen family and queerness as going together.
Right.
And because that is what I'm wondering about now, I wonder if it makes sense for us to still think of, you know, chosen family as being a queer thing, because all kinds of people base their lives around it regardless of their identities.
Right.
And all kinds of queer people have things that resemble traditional families, have traditional families, period.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, to go back to what we were saying about irony and camp, I think that Gen Z, as a more ironic generation than their predecessors, that is millennials, mm-hmm. who are probably one of the most sincere generations yes. that have ever existed, much to my chagrin as a, as an older millennial.
And to mine as a Gen Xer.
Like, I think that that's part of the reason I would propose that this film echoes with younger viewers, queer ones in particular, because they're a very ironic generation. Mm-hmm. So this film is laden with irony, with which would be very appealing to them.
Yes.
I've heard people refer to like the film's TikTok sense of humor, but since we know I don't do TikTok, I will assume that they're correct. Mm-hmm. That this film is tapping into that sensibility. If you have any viewpoints on that, listeners, if you indulge in TikTok, by all means, let us know.
I'm like, what is this TikTok you speak of?
I don't know. I mean, for the life of me, I do not... I don't want to get too far with this, but for the life of me, I still do not understand the point of TikTok. I don't understand bite-sized videos at all.
You hear that? We're both old.
I mean, I understand video essays, and I understand YouTube videos, but I just don't understand TikTok. But anyway, it just seems like a huge... As Betty White said of Facebook on SNL, it just seems like a huge waste of time. But anyway, so two other last things before we move off the queerness of Megan. Specifically, I think that part of it too is that it's the callback to the queer icon that is Chucky. Like, that's mm-hmm. its most obvious intertext as a horror film.
And here's where I leave the room for this part of the conversation, everyone, because Chucky terrifies me, so see you later.
I will say that I've not actually seen Chucky in its various iterations. It's mm-hmm. just never been my thing.
Because you're scared too, aren't you? Admit it.
I mean, yeah, I've always found dolls to be uncanny and unpleasant. I mean, that's not my kind of horror film. Like, when it comes to horror, I'm more of a creature feature kind of person, mm-hmm. or body horror. Like, that's my kind of, that's my jam. Not killer dolls and robots mm-hmm. and things.
And like, that little scary motherfucker's been tormenting me my whole life.
But apparently, like, I mean, I did not know this until recently, but Chucky has a lot of queerness, both as a, like, a queer icon, but also there's a lot of stuff in the new iterations of the story that are very queer. So, anyway, that's that. But I wanted to ask you to elaborate, because you mentioned something in the pregame about the unhealthy obsessive love that Megan has for Katie, mm-hmm. and how that is itself evocative of certain other kind of queer tropes mm-hmm. in horror.
Exactly. So for lots of horror and suspense and other kinds of dramatic movies, but particularly horror and suspense, there is that old, 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 but still... existent trope of the psycho lesbian that's like super obsessed with their object of desire to the point of, you know, committing murder, causing harm to everyone, including the person that they supposedly are in love with.
Right.
It's a long-standing trope. I call it like the single white female type mm-hmm. kind of trope in movies. It's easy to see Megan's programming, I guess. I don't know what to say. How do you describe feelings for a robot? Because I was going to say Megan's feelings, but she's a robot.
Well, I mean, she is, but she also gains sentience. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I would say that her directive, like yeah. her prime directive, if you'll forgive the mm-hmm. the jargon, is to be protective mm-hmm. of Katie.
Yeah, and if you think about how in a lot of those movies that uses trope, that's kind of like the one objective of that character is to pursue that love interest.
Right.
That is the only thing that matters to that right. character. To the exclusion of all other considerations of legality, of common sense, of anything else. I just have to be with my chosen person.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Megan's doing.
Right. And I mean, the most notable incident of that, obviously, is killing the dog because it bites Katie, mm-hmm. killing the neighbor because she enabled it, and killing the kid who's tormenting Megan, mm-hmm. or sorry, who torments Katie by... like forcing her hand over a spiky seed pod mm-hmm. and then tormenting Megan herself, which even that moment is really, as you say, like a very queer / lesbian moment, because she's like, you're gonna have to die. Like mm-hmm. that basically, like, the way she frames her, that is Megan frames her persecution of this boy, his name is Brandon, I think, is that, you know, he's a demon boy and bad boys need to be punished. Mm-hmm. I mean the queerness kind of mm-hmm. just, like, is right. It's not even subtext. It's basically right there. And so I think that that's probably the film's most explicit articulation of that phenomenon that you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
Which we see that, you know, that as you say, that the psycho-lesbian figure throughout horror and with thriller and suspense. Obviously, Rebecca with Mrs. Yes. Danvers is mm-hmm. probably the sort of paradigmatic
yes.
example. But any prison movie mm-hmm. has this figure. You see it crop up, you know, in horror films again and again. So I think that you're right, that that's also very much what it's drawing on.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a little bit then about the film's sci-fi nature. Like, not, I mean, there's obviously a ton more to talk about with the queerness, but I think that it's also important to acknowledge, like, the film's really kind of very relevant AI message. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know that this was even as relevant when the film was released, but has become increasingly so with the advent of ChatGPT mm-hmm. and all those other AI bots that are all in the news.
Yep.
And all the news outlets are in a tizzy about whether this is going to replace them and who's it going to replace and blah, 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 blah. You know, the usual panic that sets in. But I do think that this film is a very timely warning. Beneath the archness and the irony and the humor, there is actually a pretty potent social message about the risks of AI. Mm-hmm. And, like, it is a Pandora's box that is, once unleashed, you can't really control the consequences.
I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords.
I say this as I speak into a microphone, into a recording program, which I will then use to add, you know, that technology is so implicated mm-hmm. in our lives. Yeah. Like, it's inextricable from our mm-hmm. lived experience.
But there is a difference between technology and AI.
Like, is there?
Yeah.
Are we sure?
Yes.
Are we sure?
Yes, because we've had generations of technology before AI.
I mean, unless we're all living in the Matrix.
Well, if you want to go there, then there's no point in continuing this conversation.
Well, that's fair.
But there is something about this, the particular questions of AI, which is what Megan represents for mm-hmm. us, because it's not just that she's a fancy, highly technological doll, it's that she can learn.
Right.
That's what makes her do all of the things that she can do. It's not like she's pre-programmed in the way that an older computer-based technology would have been used to make a doll like that.
Exactly.
And because she can learn, we really don't know what's going to happen. You know, whereas with older technology, we know what's going to happen because we program it to do a thing. Of course, there are a few unintended consequences that pop up, but the things are designed so that we know exactly what they're going to do. With AI, the design is that we don't know what they're going to do. And right. that's the point, is that we don't know what will happen.
And that's what I love about this film's, like, really potent and razor-sharp critique of capitalism. Because a real, like, emphasis narratively is on the extent to which Gemma's employers really want to get ahead of the market. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this rush and everyone's investing and, like, it's, you know, everyone's just falling all over themselves to pour money mm-hmm. into this project, having just seen it a very brief display of Megan's capabilities without any really, I would have to ask, like, where's the ethicist on staff? Obviously there isn't one. I know,
yeah,
that. I know that, but I'm just saying that that's why they are necessary. Like, not to get on my soapbox about the humanities, but this is kind of why we're necessary, is to remind those in Silicon Valley who are first and foremost capitalists, whatever else they may say they are, is that in your rush to create new things and to expand the boundaries of human knowledge, it's always important to keep in mind the consequences of said action. Mm-hmm. And that once that genie's out of the bottle, there's no putting it back in.
Yeah. And that, again, that's one of the things that I think would be a legitimate sort of, not critique, but concern to express about AI broadly is, what is the wisdom of designing things that if they work the way that we hope that they do, they will be unpredictable.
Right.
As opposed to designing things that if they work the way that we expect them to work, then the results will be predictable. Like, this is a completely different paradigm in design and engineering than anything we've done in the past. We probably want to slow down and think about what might happen.
Right. And I think that's why horror in particular is such a useful genre to think through these phenomena and these pressing social questions. Like, it is no... full disclosure, I tend to panic about AI only mm-hmm. because as a writer, I'm always like, oh my god, what if ChatGPT replaces writers? Oh my god, blah, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm.
As my friend Jarrell, who has been on this podcast, said, I'm a chicken little sometimes, so I tend to overreact. But even so, like, I think that horror as a genre allows us as a people, as a culture, to experience our fears and to some degree to assuage them.
Because mm-hmm.
that's why it's important that Megan has to die in the end, after she's, of course, killed the capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gemma's boss, by impaling him with a sword. And, you know, at the same time as horror also kind of allows us to indulge in our greatest fears. Mm-hmm. Like, so many times in this film, we as viewers are sutured into Megan's robotic perspective as mm-hmm. she gazes at the world and evaluates other people's biological levels. Like, for example, when she looks at Katie, she can see her confidence level, her trust level, mm-hmm. anxiety, and all these other like paradigms. Yeah. And so that's a really fascinating moment in which the film itself invites us to inhabit this really perilous psychological state.
Right.
Even as, of course, it also constantly reminds us that Megan is a threat.
Right. And what happens for me, given my academic orientation, the first thing that I do when I saw those screens, which I thought were, I love those graphics that were up on screen that represented the interface from sort of inside of Megan, where, you know, we can see the data that she's working with, you know, and measuring things like trust and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, how was that defined? How were those words defined, and what criteria is Megan using to assess those things? That's my first question as soon as I see that kind of stuff, because, again, my academic orientation is interrogate those things. Mm-hmm. Don't just take them for granted. You know, get at the underlying question that's programmed into something like the algorithm for measuring trust. Right. You know, because there's a lot of... there's a lot of ideas black boxed into something like that. And if we just sort of take them for granted, all kinds of weird things can occur. What I loved is that during those moments in the movie where we're seeing Megan assess all that, we get to look at Katie's face. And so you, as an audience member, you can ask yourself, wait, we're seeing Megan measuring trust in Katie's face, but does that look like a trusting face to you as a human viewer?
And it's also, in that regard, so important that the film ultimately is about the triumph of the human, at least in the short term. Because I have a feeling that what's being suggested there is that Megan, or Katie, is not... it's so interesting that I keep conflating Megan with Katie. That Katie is, in that moment, not trusting Megan, but Gemma. It's Gemma who she's establishing the trust with, not the robot.
Yeah.
Which is why it's so important, then, that Katie also utilizes Gemma's older robotic invention, which, as you like to use the paradigm you established, is more predictable and less sophisticated than Megan, to destroy Megan, or at least to inflict such damage on her that she's then vulnerable. And that, you know, in the end, all of the outer elasticity and humanity of Megan is stripped away to reveal the robotic beneath, which is then what is basically stabbed with a screwdriver, I think, or something. So it's just, you know, it's one of those moments where the film once again reestablishes that it's the human that has to that should triumph.
Exactly.
And that's a pretty potent message, I think, for, you know, 2023, especially in the advent of all this, you know, AI that's really been all over the news.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, you know, all of that other stuff couldn't have been better press for the movie. Because, again, it's like, it's what we're all thinking about now, because we should be.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's part of the reason I think this film will go down as being a true classic, just because it is so... one of those films that is almost uncanny in its ability to tap into the moment. And so the last thing I wanted to talk about before we move into the other segments is Allison Williams. And I have to admit that my perception of Allison Williams as a star has been very distorted, because I'm familiar with her primarily through Girls, where she's insufferable, much like everybody else on Girls, and through Get Out, where she's truly evil. And so... what I like about this film is that it makes her into a heroine, like a horror heroine of the old-fashioned variety. She's, you know, not a bad person. Like, she is a little bit nerdy, not particularly socially, like, adept.
Yeah.
You know, she prefers... she has her toy collectibles and so forth. But she's also a hero, and, like, she really does come through for Katie when she needs it. And I appreciate that about her. But what I appreciate about Williams is the extent to which she is using her established star persona from Girls, where she plays this really self-indulgent millennial kind of character, to subvert that. Like, each of her roles that she's subsequently taken on clearly owe something to that earlier star persona, but she's using it in new and interesting ways to subvert it.
Exactly, because I feel like with that sort of, like, that millennial character, that I won't characterize it any more than that.
I mean, Marnie the millennial, that's pretty much what she is.
I mean, starting out with that, but then going to Get Out, to where she becomes, she's that, but taken to just sort of being evil, as opposed to just being sort of regrettably human. Right. Whereas here, she starts out with that same thing, where she takes it to actually figuring out how to develop the metal to be a hero. And it's important, because she has to figure that out. And that, I think that Williams does a great job of showing us that. Some of it comes through the script, but some of it comes just through her performance, some of her facial expressions, her gestures, and things like that, that show that she's really having to dig deep to figure out how to be there for her niece. It's not like it's not like she just sort of has an epiphany one day.
Right.
She has to keep trying to figure out what this kid needs and what she can do mm-hmm. to help her out.
Right. And I mean, you know, at first, obviously, she's so fixated on her job and getting all of, you know, the professional advancement and on, you know, she lives a rather sterile life. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at the mise-en-scene of her house, like, mm-hmm. it's very what you would expect of a software developer or, you know, someone in Silicon Valley. But, you know, as the film goes on, her, you know, and she, like I said, she and her living space are very much alike in that regard. But as she goes on, there's a sort of softening to her persona mm-hmm. that, interestingly, you know, more aligns with what we expect of. It's gendered, yes, but also toward more human. Like, she becomes less robotic and more human as exactly. the film goes on, which I think is an important thing. Not to take away that, you know, she becomes more traditionally, like, motherly mm-hmm. With all the gendered expectations that come there. But I think that the film's point is that humanity is the more important thing.
Exactly.
I don't want to, you know, I don't want to dismiss those feminist critiques, but I think that primarily the film is a humanist film in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So, kudos to Allison Williams. I think this is probably the first role I've seen her in that I actually like her as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot get over Get Out. Like, I just, like, it's a film that has rooted itself in my brainstem and just won't go away. But anyway, I didn't see her in Peter Pan, so I can't really attest to how charismatic she was in that because I just don't like those live action musicals. But I really do give her a lot of kudos for giving us a really great hero, horror heroine. In this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You have anything else you want to say about Megan before we move on?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm like, I like that, again, that she just sort of, she figures out how to be a person, which mm-hmm. I think is nice.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's the film's bottom line, is that we need to wean ourselves off of our dependence on technology and embrace the human.
And not just the dependence on technology, but also just, I think we sometimes need to step back from being so wedded to our ideas that we forget how to just live.
Yes. That is a very apt piece of wisdom that we will leave you with for this moment.
Nice.
All right, well, give us a moment and we'll be right back to do Are You Even Gay? Well, now comes my favorite part of the show. You know, periodically, Aaron's able to give me a hard time. You can give me a hard time that I just watched Magic Mike XXL, if you want.
Yeah.
I mean, you already gave me a hard time for having belatedly seen the first Magic Mike. But I will say that Magic Mike XXL is better than Magic Mike. Just gonna
because
put that down.
It's XXL.
Correct. But anyway, so I have to ask, are you familiar with the recent performance of Ariana DeBose at the BAFTA?
Well, you knew when you said recent, you already lost me.
Well, that is true. See, this is, I mean, as we know, I'm not a huge fan of the Twitter, but this is part of the reason you need to be on Twitter just so you can keep up with what's going on in the world. So,
I've heard that there's a New Mexico now, like that that's a recent thing, right?
I don't even know what to do with this man sometimes. Anyway, so if you, to be clear, I did not watch it on the night of the BAFTAs, because, I mean, who watches the BAFTAs, first of all, is my first question. But clearly some people were, and it became a viral phenomenon. Now, if you do know who Ariana DeBose is, right?
Yes, I've heard that name.
Well, that's a good start. She starred in the new West Side Story.
Oh, yes.
And she is famously a queer icon, mm-hmm. Both because she is herself bi and also because she's just a great singer and performer. So she did this introductory performance at the BAFTAs, which I don't know if that's the traditional, because again, who watches the BAFTAs is
literally
the question that keeps coming
no
up.
No one.
Except for other celebrities who are already there. But anyway, she did this opening number where she was basically, it was kind of like a hymn, if you will, to the many great women who are being nominated. So And arguably the line of the night was Angela Bassett did the thing. So it was this whole big phenomenon. I just watched it recently. I mean, it's one of those moments where I'm like, God, people are so terminally online they can't function without making a thing. But anyway, I'm just curious. So you didn't watch it at all? You had no familiarity with this at all?
None at all.
Well, I had to ask, are you even gay?
I'm going to push back and say yes, I am still gay, even though I did not watch it, because as we started out the segment saying, no one watches the BAFTAs, first of
all. I know,
all.
But if you had been plugged into the online discourse that is where all the gays are, like, you would
not
know.
Not all of them. Because I'm not.
Well, all the gays but you and like a handful of other old lesbians. Like
exactly. And we count too.
Well, I stand by my interrogation. Are you even gay? I hope you are.
And but... I'm going to say yes. I still get to count as gay.
I mean, I do. I will say that. I mean, I love Ariana DeBose, and I'm very sad that she deactivated Twitter because apparently it was just too much. Like, which is a reminder, which we'll get to in a moment when we do our PS Gay, that, you know, our icons are people too, and that, like, you know, this even more harsh attention that is paid to celebrities at moments like this can be a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I'm sad that she didn't watch it, but Ariana DeBose is amazing, and she deserves all of the accolades and all the love, and please stop making fun of her. Okay, so we'll be right back to do a PS Gay. Okay, so now we get to do something a little less fun, because, you know, we don't like to lecture here at Queens of the Bees. Actually, that's a complete lie. I love nothing more than getting on a soapbox.
He's standing at a podium right now.
You know, I don't like to lecture, which is, again, not true. But there was a recent meme that made the rounds on Twitter. I really should unplug from this. Like, I should take a lesson from Megan and unplug from the world of social media. But anyway, it was a meme of, like, what is your opinion about the gay community that gets you this response? And it's a meme of Lois from Family Guy being beat up by children. And there were many questionable assertions. One person said that water-based lube is better than silicone, which is false. But there were a number of others, one of which was a rather tone-deaf articulation that they didn't hook up with Paws Guys because too many people died in the AIDS crisis and all this other stuff, which, of course, then ignited a firestorm and went viral, if you'll forget the expression. And putting aside for the moment the ethics of that whole AIDS discourse, what perplexes me about these moments within, like, gay Twitter that become viral is that they become toxic in the worst possible way. I guess there's no real positive way to be toxic, right? Unless it's Britney Spears, you have no business being toxic. But I find sometimes that the gays on Twitter are doing all the wrong things and really engaging in very unproductive discussions that are, you know, obviously there's a lot of really important discussions to have about HIV, about sexual health, about one's choices. Like, obviously everyone has the right to make their own choices in that regard, but I don't think that Twitter is a very good space in which to have those discussions. And more to the point, I don't think that everyone needs to share their opinion about every single thing on Twitter all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Michelle Goldberg put it best in the New York Times that we all could do better if we knew less about each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think there's a lot to that.
Yep. Why do you think I'm not on?
I know, I give Aaron a hard time about not being on social media, but I do think that it's probably in the aggregate a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. I gotta say, I enjoy life away from all of that crap.
Right, because I do think that Twitter, and I use this particular, and I only brought up this specific tweet just because it was the one that was, you know, the flashpoint that brought, you know, sort of brought everyone out of the woodwork to chime in on. And I just think that there are important discussions that we all need to have with ourselves and with our partners and with, you know, our doctors and so forth. But going on Twitter and getting on a soapbox and using what I call Twitter voice,
mm-hmm.
which is an assertion of one's own inviolability and sort of authority about something that you know nothing about,
mm-hmm.
or that you are literally just wrong about, is really degrading. And I think that because in our culture, and I'm guilty of this too, that we assume that Twitter is real life or that there's some direct relationship between Twitter and real life, I feel like that gives us a very distorted sense of who we are. Like, I mean that in a sense of who we are as individuals,
mm-hmm.
but also who we are as a community,
yeah.
and who we are as a society.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really, really corrosive.
Right. And, you know, just to piggyback on that, I feel like there's just this weird lack of understanding that a lot of people have between, you know, sort of public, private, and intimate spaces. They're, you know, so I use three words. They're public, private, and intimate. Like, some things are private. They're really just for you.
Right.
Some things are intimate. They're just for you and people close to you. And then some things are public, you know, that are meant sort of for anyone who's listening, right?
Right.
Whether or not you want to hook up with somebody based on their status is not a public thing, simply put. I just don't understand any sort of public declaration like that. I'm like, what's right. the point
right.
of something like that? But then I'm not much of a social media person myself.
Right.
So I don't get that kind of statement as a revealing comment about the self, first of all. I also don't get whatever point you might be trying to make about some larger, either health or political issue. I don't get that either, right. coming from that. It just seems like a nonsensical thing to make as a public claim, because it just doesn't fit there.
Right, and I guess this comes down to the essential problem, which we're going to have to, in addition to all the AI stuff, we're going to have to really grapple with the attention economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that as someone who obviously is as a independent creator of a podcast and as a newsletter who needs social media to get the word out about my product. Like, I understand the need for that, but I feel like what gets lost is any kind of nuance or subtlety, like, because everyone's just clamoring for attention, and the only way to get it is to say the most outrageous thing.
Yep.
And that's really bad for us as gay people. Like, I think that because sometimes the only access young gay people have to the broader gay community is through Twitter, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, not that we have to put the best foot forward, I'm not going to go down that argument. I'm just saying that sometimes a little bit of discretion
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of taking a step back
mm-hmm.
and reserve can yes. really be good for you as a person,
yes.
but also for us as a community. And I think that that's one thing that I think we as gay Twitter trademark are going to have mm-hmm. to grapple with, is that larger moral question going forward.
Yeah, I also don't think that best foot forward is a problem.
Well, yeah. No, I didn't want to get into like that, you know, no, can't get pride, that kind of
thing. No, I understand. I get what you're saying. I think the people making those claims are just wrong.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with wanting to make a good impression in those kinds of highly public, highly visible sorts of things because of all of the stuff that you just talked about.
Right.
No one's saying that you can't do all of the other things, but not every public place is the place for your private and intimate things. Simply put, that's just a thing that's true in life.
Right.
That's not a queer thing. That's not even a sexuality thing. That's just a life thing.
So we're dishing out lots of good advice on this week's Queens of the Bees. So if you want to like publicize that, we would gladly welcome that. So again, just to sort of conclude, sometimes less is more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good lesson going forward.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll be right back to do our little outro. And that's all. I don't know why I was... All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining us for another fabulous episode of Queens of the Bees. We really loved talking about Megan. We hope that you all enjoyed listening to us talk about Megan. So given that I just talked to Aaron about his lack of social media savvy, I won't even bother asking this week because I know the answer. For better or worse, you can find me on Twitter at TJ West and the number 3. I'm currently set on private, so if you want to follow me, just give it a click and I will follow you back. You can also follow me, my personal account on Instagram, as Thomas West and the number 3. But you can also follow the Queens of the Bees Instagram, which is Queens of the Bees, without the apostrophe, obviously. We do a lot of bite-sized reviews on there, both of films we do here on the pod, but also of other things. We're going to start doing little bite-sized queer film history or screen history snippets every so often, so that'll be fun. So look forward to that. But you know how it is with me. Like, I say that now, and maybe 6 months I'll get around to it. So just be prepared for that. As I alluded to earlier, you can also find me on Substack, where I write a newsletter called Omnivorous. I've been really writing a lot of gay stuff on there, so please check that out and subscribe if you haven't already. And if you have a few moments, please remember to rate or review us wherever you listen to your podcasts, whether that's on Spotify, whether it's on Apple Podcasts, or wherever it is. Please make sure to leave us some comments if you like, preferably positive, but we'll take constructive feedback if you like, because every little bit of exposure helps, and the more people that rate and review us, the easier it is for other people to find us. Obviously, we're going to keep doing this regardless, but we would like more listens, so please do that. So I think that's all I have for our listeners this week. So for Queens of the Bees, I'm your fabulous host, TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will be back with you soon.